Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
President Trump's new guidance for pregnant women and Tylenol.
Don't take Tylenol. There's no downside.
It's an announcement that is bound to raise so much fear, so much anxiety among pregnant women.
Knowing what I know about the risks of Tylenol in pregnancy versus the risks of an uncontrolled fever, I would take Tylenol again in this pregnancy.
Hey, Chicago, it's Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the latest local news in and around Chicago. But first, one big headline over the past few weeks. Well, it's that the Trump administration is linking Tylenol use during pregnancy to autism.
Acetaminophen. Is that okay? Which is basically commonly known as Tylenol during pregnancy can be associated with a very increased risk of autism.
That news headline fits into a long history of misunderstanding and blame on mothers of children with autism. So let's peel the curtain back just a bit. Now, I produced this episode, and I originally got the idea after I read an article from The 19th. It was titled, "This Isn't the First Time Moms Have Been Blamed for Their Kids' Autism." So, of course, I was intrigued. I was also surprised to learn that the blame game, well, it goes way back to the 1940s, a term called refrigerator mothers. Now, that is a claim that moms who were emotionally distant or maybe cold toward their child, well, they were the reason that the child might develop autism. Sound crazy? Yeah, well, that's because it kind of is. It later got debunked. But needless to say, I knew that there would be a lot to discuss in this conversation. So let's get into it. At the table was J.J. Hanley, who's a mom of an adult with autism. She's also producer of the 2003 documentary Refrigerator Mothers. And Dr. Letha Valarapalli-Soria, who's a psychologist and director of the Autism Assessment Research Treatment and Services Center, or ARTS Center, at Rush. Clear it up. Does Tylenol cause autism?
Likely not. And we don't know. And when we don't know, the answer is no.
And is it okay for pregnant women to take the drug for pain and fever?
Yes. Every medical professional group in this country has asserted that we do not need to change our practices. So all is the same before and after those headlines.
JJ, I want to get your reaction when you first heard the news conference a few weeks ago linking autism to Tylenol. Did that seem strange to you? Or had you heard it before?
I had not heard it before. I'd heard a lot of other things before, and I'd been part of asking questions as a parent about what way to go, how to deal with what I was seeing in my child when he was younger. What came back to me was that professionals, as you stated, professionals, people in a position of authority, mm-hmm. And parents have to be collaborative and communicative and share knowledge with each other and trust each other to get to solutions. Because as you've said, we don't know what the cause is. We don't know what the cause is. Mm. It's probably a myriad of things. And so I was a little surprised, to be honest. I never received that directive.
Yeah, and I wonder what you think, JJ, of the impact of this type of messaging coming from the nation's capital, from the White House.
I think it's heavy. I mean, these are individuals in a position of authority that people listen to. And I think to proclaim something as strongly as they've proclaimed it creates the chaos that we're talking about now and the concern. And parents are already afraid. Parents are already, in young parents especially, are distrustful of a lot of things related to treatment of their children in a medical office. Mm. And so it just adds to fear unnecessarily. And it's something that we've seen over and over again over the years, especially when it comes to autism.
Yeah. And you're shaking your head, doctor, because now you say you are sharing resources constantly with parents coming to your center and are confused by the messaging.
Absolutely. I mean, it's fear, it's guilt. And in the place of that, we're all human and we're going to want to do the best for our children and we're going to want to know. And so we do, you know, I think the autism and medical community all over the country is trying to put out the information. And we've shared some of those resources with you to share with the listeners.
Right.
There are resources that really lay out what we know and what we don't know.
Yes.
And JJ, you're absolutely right. The causes of autism are really complex.
Yes.
And so this is simplifying something in a gray area, and we don't have the answers, but we do know.
Yeah.
We do know that there's a complexity that is complexity on the biology and complexity on the environment and how those variables interact over the years. We are going to know. The good news is, and I would like to share some good news, is
sure.
The administration has put attention on this. They've put some money behind this on this autism data science initiative that was announced over the summer around the same time as the sort of, we're going to find out the cause by September, but in that push, they've funded, this is ASDI grants, they've funded really solid centers across scientific groups across the country to study the complex link between biology and mm-hmm. environment.
Yeah, it's layered, as you were telling me when we spoke before this program, and we will dig more into what the science does say. So that's why I'm really glad that you're here at the table with us. I want to dig a little bit more into this history piece of the blame for autism, JJ. This started with a term, as I mentioned a moment ago, refrigerator mothers, mothers being frigid and cold toward their kids. So that's why your kid has autism, right? Wrong, because it was disproven later. But psychologist Bruno Bettelheim popularized it back in the 60s. What was happening back then?
So again, an individual in a position of authority who, you know, he had standing. And he didn't coin the term refrigerator mothers. That was coined in the early 1940s by another I think a researcher named Leo Kanner.
Mm-hmm.
But Bruno Bettelheim took the phrase and ran with it beginning in the early 60s and began the orthogenic school in Chicago, here in Chicago, where he promoted this theory as fact that the reason children develop autism is because of their cold, frigid mothers who either psychologically mishandled them, had a secret death wish for them, defrosted long enough only to conceive a child and then went back into their frigid mothering.
Wow.
And mothers who were accused of this, this was a blanket blame, a shroud of blame that these women lived with, and they lived with it for generations. And so if a child came in with the symptoms that the doctor is very familiar with, that I'm familiar with, of somebody who is expressing autistic spectrum disorder or being on the spectrum, she would be told that she was the problem.
Mm.
And often her child was taken away from her. In fact, the orthogenic school was there to keep the parents out. Bruno Bettelheim took the children in and treated them, and the mothers were not allowed to see them. You know, again, I've gotten older. I try to be a little bit forgiving because maybe forgiving is strong, but I'm trying to be forgiving because he did what he knew. And what he knew was life in a concentration camp in Buchenwald. He came to the States to rebuild and reinvent, and he did reinvent. He was not a medical or psychological professional when he arrived here. And he saw what he thought was a similarity between the Nazi concentration camp guards and the mothers of autistic children and the prisoners of those concentration camps and the autistic children.
That seems like an extreme
comparison. It was extreme. And that's where, we, you know, as we're today talking about extremes and blanket statements and lacking that collaborative back and forth and trying to figure out together.
Right. Well, here's the thing. This is personal for you, JJ, as we've mentioned. I just want to hear a bit about your son and the early days leading up to diagnosis. What did the doctor say to you? Start there.
Tim was born in 1993. In 1996, I took him to our area pediatrician and had a list of concerns that I had. He had lost his language development at 18 months. He was extremely self-isolating. He had increasing sensory integration issues. He was perseverative, meaning he would do things over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of self-stimming. He was very isolated from the family and from the community.
And you knew something wasn't right.
I knew something wasn't right. And the doctor took a look at my son and looked at me and he said, point blank, you are neurotic and you are overbearing, having given him this list of concerns. Leave him alone. He will be just fine. That was the first time. That was the blame I experienced. 9 months later, Tim was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, and thus began my journey to help my son. But on the path, there were also other professionals who had beliefs that they shared with me and helped me and wanted me to buy into whatever their beliefs were. And as the doctor said, you know, you have to go at this with an open mind, and we've learned a lot since then. But Timo, when I got this accusation, I listened to him for 9 months. I listened. I was okay. The doctor knows. He knows what he's saying.
Yeah.
And we lost 9 months of intervention that could have helped Tim.
You were thinking, I need to stop being overbearing.
Right.
I'm doing too much.
Yes, I'm doing too much. I am overbearing and I am neurotic. There's no doubt about it. Ask both of my sons. That's for sure.
But whether that gave your child autism, that's what's in question here.
And I had an older son. He's not on the spectrum.
Right.
But those are the things that we're thinking about. What did I do? Did I drink a glass of wine when I was pregnant with him? I started to have lots of guilt once he was diagnosed. Go to the library, which at the time the internet was still quite young, so there really wasn't anything on the internet about autism. That's when I discovered Bruno Bettelheim's book, The Empty Fortress.
And then you thought,
and read that book and learned about real mother blame. I was blamed. I came through. These women lived with a shroud of blame their entire lives. Mm-hmm. And it was because of, you know, treatment, the Bruno Bettelheim refrigerator mother theory.
So I look back to you, Dr. Valarapalli Soria, and I say, what does the science say? I mean, how does a mother or father's genes factor into autism diagnosis? As you said before, multifactorial.
Yeah. So just on the genetic side, we have... We'll talk about there's kind of like three buckets of ways the genetics of autism have emerged, and there are hundreds of genes. We'll talk about this, right? So, but, you know, one way is that it's spontaneous. It doesn't come from the parents at all, either parents. That's a portion of what we understand about the genetics of autism. It's totally spontaneous. Another way it might be is that it's inherited, and it's inherited that you might inherit one thing that has like a big effect, and it could be from one or both parents. It could be lots of little things that accumulate and may or may not. So many of us have those. And then it could be that it's inherited and it's spontaneous not inherited, not spontaneous. So like you're already, as I'm like rambling through this,
it's
a combination of things. It's calculus, multi-level calculus. Like it is not a inherited. And that's when we talk about the genetics, we were really careful to talk to families about what 20 years of really focusing on genetics has taught us is that it is not simple. And just because your child had autism, yes, your siblings have a higher risk of autism, mm-hmm. but what that looks like is going to be different for different families.
So JJ, you outline in your documentary, it's about an hour long, fantastic watch. You did this, over 20 years ago, and it's still so relevant today, right? What did you hear from the moms featured in the doc?
The mothers shared stories of blame, and the message that they shared was, it's hard to say, their message was a powerful one of experiencing blame, extreme loneliness, feeling completely at sea with their children. And all of the mothers who are featured in the documentary, by the way, there were eight mothers whose stories they tell themselves have children with profound autism. Mm-hmm. And the doctor knows that we're now talking a broader spectrum on which my son is on the higher end, but their children had profound autism. And the question that ran through the entire thing is, I heard what they were telling me, but I couldn't really believe it. And yet they were telling me this was true. And here was somebody in a position of authority saying, this is what it is. And I was left without any way to counter that. And so their stories are beautiful. They're poignant. They're powerful today because it reminds us that, as the doctor said, we're still trying to understand this. We're treating it differently than it was treated in the 60s, where you took the kid away from the mother, and a lot of these women's children were put through a variety of
right.
things we wouldn't do today to a child on the spectrum, and so they were left at sea to deal with this. But the one thing that came out of this film is that these women remain their children's greatest advocates, their greatest loves. Mm-hmm. They are the one human being in that child's life who is stuck by that child always.
Interesting.
So it's a poignant message today for all of us to remember that just because you're in a position of power doesn't mean you have the answers.
Yeah. Does this culture of blaming mothers for their child's developmental or mental health, doctor, does that exist elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a legacy that is that has been around for a long time. And I'm not a sociologist or anthropologist, but this is for sure a legacy of the cultural issues that we are dealing with now, patriarchy, colonialism. And we see this in cultures where mental health access is limited and or knowledge of autism is newer. You know, autism does not discriminate. Does not discriminate in any way, mm-hmm. age, or yeah. So like this is all over, and we have. I'm South Asian, and I see it in family members and my children when there are issues that it is the mom that is the problem, and so you know this is it's just an easy target, and I'm sad that you know your documentary came out 20 years ago, that the history that you were talking about and so poignantly wrote about from the 1960s is still something we are fighting despite
still
the advocacy.
Still so relevant. And listen, talk from the White House goes a step further. I mean, we don't even have time to dig into this, but at a cabinet meeting, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr., recently claimed boys who receive circumcisions at birth get twice the rate as non-circumcised, citing a 2015 Danish study. And so basically suggesting that the pain of getting circumcised equals autism. We also saw Friday the department overseeing special education was gutted by the Trump administration. What do these moves signal to you, doctor?
That
are we taking this seriously enough?
No, we're not. What's happening now is that the focus is being redirected to areas that meet political agendas, and that's why the conversations around Tylenol and autism and Luguvern, all of these things, all of these go down political lines. And as much as we can, it would be, you know, shows like this, I hope, can help us pull away from those, because there are, these are questions that are out there, and there's so many other questions out there.
Yeah.
That if we can just pull away and really focus on what we know and what we don't know, and then if we don't know something, not rush to find an answer.
Yeah. So to recap, the cause of autism, still largely a mystery, but with several factors involved. It's layered.
We know that it's multifactorial.
Yeah.
So there are some areas, very few cases, maybe 10, 15% that we might know. That means there's a lot we don't know. And so autism is a big category. It very likely, the field really thinks that over the next several decades, we're going to really understand it the way we understand cancer, in that there are many different types of cancer, causes of cancer, and those are also multifactorial causes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So leave us with this, JJ, a message to moms listening to us right now. They've got a child with autism. What should they hear from you?
Be strong. Don't be afraid, but it's easy to say that. You're going to be afraid when we have a child who has something going on that we don't understand. It's frightening, but it is scary. But don't be scared, and don't deny what you're seeing. That's another piece of advice I would give to young parents, not just the mothers,
yeah,
but the fathers too.
Absolutely.
And the families. If you are not sure you can advocate well enough for your child, because some people just, it's not their thing. I could advocate and look, but some people, it's like, it's not my thing. Find somebody who can advocate for
yeah.
you and get treatment as soon as you can.
Yeah.
Behavioral intervention therapy, speech and language therapy, sensory integration therapy. I tried everything, and some of it was really fantastic and worked really well. So get out there, ask
questions.
Be
strong.
Be strong.
Love that advice. JJ Hanley is a filmmaker and mother of an adult with autism. And Dr. Letha Velarapalli Surya is a psychologist and director of the Autism Assessment Research Treatment and Services Center at Rush. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Okay, now it's time to catch you up on the big stories of the day. We checked in with WBEZ news anchor Claire Lane and Sun-Times reporter and assistant editor on race, class, and communities, Nader Issa. There was a wild scene in East Chicago yesterday. Federal agents intentionally crashed their SUV into a vehicle while trying to arrest two people that they say are in the country without legal status. So Claire kicked things off with what we knew at that point.
Right. And we should note that this was documented on video captured on local security cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And there is footage of this at WBEZ.org. But the crash, the feds admitted to using a precision immobilization technique, a pit maneuver, to stop the car that they were pursuing, and which agents sort of hit the rear back corner of that car, causing it to spin out.
It
is quite a scene on video. And it's a somewhat risky maneuver that's restricted, actually, by some police departments.
Mm-hmm.
So after the crash, after the spin out, two people in the car were fleeing. The Sun-Times reports a large group of onlookers and protesters gathered, and then federal agents deployed tear gas, pepper balls, and smoke grenades onto that crowd, which mm-hmm. is a scene familiar to
the
us at this point.
The routine that we've been seeing, yeah.
Right? Chicago police then said that some protesters allegedly threw objects at federal agents. Attorneys say at least four protesters were detained. And in a Department of Homeland Security statement, federal officials say that Border Patrol agents, as you mentioned, were conducting an immigration enforcement traffic stop.
Yeah.
But then they alleged that the car that they were pursuing rammed into their vehicle. So again, it's one of these hearsay, then video sort of disproving that,
mm-hmm.
and people asking for accountability from the federal government.
Yeah, and Nader, among those shocking images that Claire describes, something I saw on the WBEZ Instagram account is sort of the aftermath of this crash, right? Border Patrol pointed a crowd control weapon right in the face of a protester. This is at point blank range. They, again, used tear gas, pepper balls, and smoke grenades, and also arrested a teen. Now, he's a U.S. citizen, and he was detained in an unknown location for 5 hours. All of this playing out in the middle of a Chicago neighborhood, Nader. I mean, what do you make of this?
Well, it's what we've seen the past 5 weeks here with the federal government's pretty aggressive deportation campaign. You know, we've seen these scenes over and over again on neighborhood streets in the city, in the suburbs. Starting from the video that Claire described, it was pretty jarring seeing the car so, you know, aggressively ram into the car that they were pursuing on this high-speed chase down a residential block. And then, one thing that happened when the Fed deployed tear gas is that 13 Chicago police officers were also affected by the tear gas. And so it just sort of shows the indiscriminate use of these crowd control weapons and chemical irritants. And it also, when it comes to the Fed's use of these weapons, a federal judge said they're not supposed to be deploying tear gas without warning the crowd twice, for example. That didn't seem to happen yesterday.
Yeah. The 15-year-old boy who was detained, now his lawyers say he was essentially, quote, disappeared for those 5 hours as if under an authoritarian regime. I want to read a little bit of a statement from Romanucci and Blandin. That's the law firm. They write, quote, the teenager, who is Hispanic and African-American, was grabbed off a Chicago East Side street at approximately 12:30 p.m. Central Time, slammed to the ground, kneed in the back, and zip-tied by CBP agents. He was then transported to a federal law enforcement facility not affiliated with CBP or ICE, where CBP agents held him, handcuffed him in the back of a vehicle in a garage, never booking him, never reading him his rights, never stating why he was detained, and never allowing him to contact his mother. I mean, folks, Claire, Nader, how do you respond to this here? Because I know as a mom, I would be freaking out. I mean, I think she said he has a heart condition, right? And that heightened her anxiety. Claire, what comes to mind?
I think it's worth noting that these crowds of onlookers, concerned citizens, family members, in some cases, you know, they're not getting any smaller. And as the Rapid Response Network's, this was Oscar Sanchez was on scene, told the Sun-Times, when you're using these kinds of tactics, right, federal agents, he says, are, quote, asking for people to be hospitalized, which is, you know, what you might see if someone's getting kneed in the chest or pepper sprayed in the face. So bringing attention to some of the diversity of these crowds, we've got young people, we've got in some cases teenagers, and some cases elderly people, and raising the question, you know, is this level of aggression, these military tactics, these elevated tactics, why are they even being used?
Yeah, Nader.
Yeah, I mean, something I think is important to realize here is in a lot of these cases, it's not like there are protesters coming from all over to, you know, tell ICE that they're not welcome in the city. I mean, some cases that's true, but it seems like yesterday that's just neighbors. This happened on their block, a block away from their home. They heard it while they're inside their home of this federal vehicle crashing into, ramming into the back of another car. And they came outside to see what's going on. Mm. And so it is sort of like things are coming to people's doorsteps rather than they're going out of their way to be violent or aggressive toward federal agents like the Department of Homeland Security would have you believe.
Yeah.
And we should note that they're coming to people's doorsteps and they have Nest cameras, right?
Yes.
And these neighbors, these citizens are informed. They know that if they're going to go out and ask questions, see what's going on, they're going to be recording things, which is seeming to cause a lot of problems, right?
Absolutely. And while all of this was going down, believe it or not, Nader, there's more news. You published a story about Meta, which is, as we know, Facebook's parent company. Meta took down a Chicago Facebook page that's been used lately to track ICE operations happening in our area. This came at the request of the U.S. Justice Department. So first of all, Nader, why don't you tell us more about ICE sightings Chicagoland?
Yeah, so this was a Facebook group. It had, you know, a lot of people, about 80,000 members in this group. And it's been used pretty widely over the past few weeks to report sightings of federal agents, whether it's ICE, Border Patrol, any other federal agency that's enforcing immigration. And, you know, people just go on the page. They say, hey, we see an unmarked vehicle with law enforcement agents near this school or near this grocery store or near this church. And so it's been used to report sightings and sort of warn neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the area, you should take steps to protect yourself and get away from it.
Yeah. What reasoning did the Justice Department give for making the request?
They said that the group was being used to dox federal agents, which means sort of exposing their exposing their personal identities, being used to then attack them. They, you know, this sort of followed right-wing internet activist provocateur Laura Loomer, who posted about the group a couple days before the DOJ made this request. Mm-hmm. And she claimed that Facebook groups like that are leading to people being killed. There's no evidence to suggest that.
Mm. Similar apps have been removed from the Apple Store too, right, Nader?
Yeah, there's one called IceBlock. There's one called Red Dot. These apps use public data to sort of track and alert people if there are federal immigration agents near their homes. They were, again, at the request of the federal government after a Laura Loomer post banned from the Apple and Google stores. And again, these requests are coming from the federal government, but then the tech companies are making the decision themselves to take that action. Mm-hmm. And those two apps in particular, they said, you know, the technology is no different than your Google Maps or Apple Maps that tells you about speed traps coming up. This is just a publicly available resource. There's no evidence that it was being used to harm any federal immigration agents. And we should also note, there have not been widespread reports of agents being injured in the Chicago area. There was one, the officer who shot and killed a gentleman in Franklin Park. He had, you know, supposedly been seriously injured, but then we received body camera footage where he says his injuries were minor. And then another officer was hurt his leg chasing a protester outside of the Broadview ICE facility.
Wow.
So there just have not been these widespread reports that the Department of Homeland Security is pointing to.
Mm. And Claire, it is now day 15 of this federal government shutdown, still dragging on. Now air traffic controllers are speaking up.
Yes. So yesterday, controllers received their last partial paycheck. So now, from today onward, they will be working without pay until the government can restore itself. And air traffic controllers nationwide are essentially just asking passengers, asking travelers to call their congressmen to sort of make a plea to end the government shutdown. The longer the shutdown continues, the longer air controllers will go without pay. And they're also still expected to work in the meantime, right? So this is going to result in lots of call-outs, which we're already starting to see, and lots of delays for passengers, including at O'Hare and Midway airports.
Mm. A follow-up on something that I mentioned on the show yesterday morning, the TSA video of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem blaming Democrats for the shutdown. It will not show at O'Hare and Midway. The Chicago Department of Aviation said that they'll join a growing number of airports that are not going to show that political message. Other stories you're keeping an eye on, Claire?
Well, this is kind of a fun one. Folks might remember Rat Hole. This was a piece of sidewalk that was indented in Roscoe Village. WBEZ even made a tote bag for some of our members as sort of commemorating this. But there was a statistical analysis.
We had a tote bag?
We did have a rat hole tote.
How did I miss the tote bag?
It might be available in storage.
Who do I call about this tote bag?
But here's the twist. We'll see if you still want it. This was an analysis of the rat hole, which suggests that there is a 99% likelihood that the hole was made by not a rat, Sasha, but a squirrel.
Wait, what?
Yes, the New York Times reported this. They had a team of researchers that studied the indent.
It's a squirrel hole.
Tried to identify the rodent, and it was that this piece of sidewalk was excavated. It was removed, so they used photographs, mammal specimens, and concluded that it was either an eastern gray squirrel or a fox squirrel that likely had landed on the sidewalk from a nearby tree. If you want to check this out yourself,
it
was published today in the journal Biology Letters.
This is the most shocking piece of information I've learned all day.
Squirrel hole. Believe
squirrel
it.
Hole. Doesn't roll off the tongue quite as easily as rat hole.
No. And people got married at this thing.
Oh,
I mean,
right.
this was a huge sort of neighborhood cultural phenomenon, but yeah, squirrel hole now.
Squirrel hole now. All right. Well, one more story that I wanted to make sure we squeeze in here. State lawmakers in Springfield, they're working to address the so-called transit cliff. The Regional Transportation Authority said yesterday that that budget gap rose from $202 million to $230 million. And lawmakers are hoping to hammer out a deal to fix the problem by October 30th. We're all waiting with bated breath, of course, to make sure that they do. Now, Nader, as we wrap up here, I know the Sun-Times is just out doing incredible on-the-ground reporting to bring Chicagoans the very latest on ICE and Border Patrol actions that just are ever evolving across the city and region, if I might say so. We're also tracking when they cross the line. And you've been keeping an eye on how right-wing media and social media is kind of spinning the federal presence in Chicago. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, well, we've seen, you know, this very wide-ranging network of media, whether that's Department of Homeland Security, camera crews, you know, working directly for the government, or social media influencers who, you know, are on the right, or people who call themselves independent journalists who are on the right. They're in some cases embedding with the government when they're going on these raids. We saw that with the South Shore raid that, you know, we've talked about extensively over the past couple weeks. And there are just videos and reports in this sort of like action style, like action movie style that they're putting out with action music and these really flattering shots of agents. And it does not always match the reality of what's happening on the ground. Just like, you know, last month we had Border Patrol agents patrolling the Chicago River.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure who they were supposed to find on the Chicago River, but they had a camera crew with them and posted pictures and videos of that operation. And so it is, a lot of it does seem targeted to showing the president's base elsewhere around the country that they are sort of doing this hostile military takeover of Chicago to tamp down on crime, like he's saying.
Well, real quick, Nader, going forward, what else are you going to be watching when it comes to the federal presence here?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious next big thing is what happens with the National Guard. Mm-hmm. We've had two court rulings that have sort of put that on pause. So it'll be interesting to see when and how that moves forward. And we also just need to keep an eye on the people who are being, you know, detained, because these are, no matter what the federal administration says, these are people oftentimes with families who have lives here and, you know, are members of their community and contribute to their community. And so we do want to try to document as many of those lives as we can and tell people about the folks who are being taken.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sasha Ann Simons, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, just head to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.
What happens when you say yes for an entire year? Join WBEZ on October 26th for an evening with Titan of Television Shonda Rhimes as she recounts lessons from her best-selling memoir, Year of Yes. Tickets at wbez.org/events.